The Murthy Law Firm has been clarifying U.S. immigration laws and procedures for foreign nationals since 1994. We are happy to offer this free service. Please listen to copyright information and restrictions at the end of this recording.
Good afternoon. This is Sheila Murthy, President and CEO of the Murthy Law Firm. We're so honored and delighted to have you all joining us this afternoon for our discussion on the topic of self-sponsored petitions. And our focus, of course, will be the extraordinary ability and the national interest waiver. But more important, joining me today are two of my esteemed colleagues at the Murthy Law Firm, attorney Aaron Finkelstein, the managing attorney of the firm and has been with the firm for maybe 25 years, quarter of a century, Aaron. Great job. You're a saint to hang around the likes of me, so we appreciate that. And Anna Stepanova, an assistant managing attorney, another brilliant colleague whom I'm so proud and honored to call both of them my esteemed colleagues at the Murthy Law Firm. So as we just said, we're going to be talking about the two kinds of options that are available for those who are exempt from a job offer requirement, which means that the person can self-sponsor themselves without having the employer. In some cases, we do have employers that actually lend their name, but it is not critical or required or essential for the extraordinary ability and the national interest waiver. And this option obviously is extremely attractive for those who do not have a sponsoring employer, especially in light of the many layoffs that have been afflicting the IT industry and a lot of professionals. No doubt that the eligibility criteria or standard is very high, especially for extraordinary ability. It cannot be easily achieved. But our goal with the three of us having a discussion today is really to provide you guys with a general overview of these categories so that you have a slightly better understanding in case you are interested in pursuing these categories. And of course, the Murthy Law Firm has approximately over 30 years of experience preparing these applications and petitions, even before the firm was started when I was working as an immigration lawyer at other firms. So we have a lot of experience, a lot of expertise, a fantastic team with the attorney and paralegal who's been doing this exclusively for close to 30 years at the firm as well. So with that, I'm going to ask Aaron to explain a little bit more. Aaron, what are the two self-sponsored categories?
Sure. Well, before we jump into that, I'd be remiss to fail to mention Anna also has been with us for going on 17 or 18 years. So that also is quite remarkable. And so I just, you know, she's kind of a Johnny come late to the game, almost only two decades. But I think that her experience is well is extraordinary and well worth the value. It's exactly like what you were saying, Sheila.
I couldn't agree with you, Aaron, more. I thought I said both are brilliant and smart. But in my mind, of course, I know how long everyone's been, but I forget that it's important to mention it because the audience may or may not be aware of what we all know. Sorry, please go ahead.
It's as we become whiter and wiser, as they say. But, you know, so it's exactly like you were saying, Sheila. There are two self-sponsoring categories. Individuals can self-sponsor in the EB-1A, the employment-based first preference category, the A portion of it. That's for people with extraordinary ability. And EB-2 category for national interest for people with advanced degree or of exceptional ability. Now, at the outset, it's important to understand that a self-filing petition, I-140 petition, may not provide a faster track to a green card because they're still subject to the waiting period and availability of the priority dates that are associated with the EB-1 and EB-2 category, which we see published on a monthly basis, through the Visa Bulletin. In fact, if you're looking at the time it takes to prepare a well-founded petition, that can take several months, which is subject to, and it is subject to immigrant visa eligibility. So it may mean that it's the same time frame or a similar time frame between the initiation of the case and the approval of the actual green card itself.
Thank you, Aaron. Yes, so that's unfortunate that for many, many, many years, the EB1 priority dates were completely current for Indian nationals. But as more and more and more people started wanting to be eligible, especially EB1C, by going abroad, that category, unfortunately, has also started to backlog, particularly for India and China. Okay, so let's delve a little bit deeper, because now you're like, great, there are these two fantastic options, but what are the criteria? What do I do? How does it work? So I'm going to invite Anna to describe the EB1A extraordinary ability category to explain who are the kind of category of people who may be eligible. Anna?
Well, thank you, Sheila and Aaron. First of all, I want to say I'm humbled by your grand introduction, and I want to say that I wouldn't be who I am without your mentorship and support from both of you. And it's a wonderful opportunity to talk today about the self-sponsoring category, because they benefit so many people, or potentially may benefit so many people, and not everybody understands what is involved. So first, I just want to say what the law requires, that then we can delve into each type of element in the requirement, give examples. But technically, EB1A, a category for people with extraordinary ability, is for somebody, obviously, who can demonstrate extraordinary ability specifically in the sciences, arts, education, business, or athletics. And this extraordinary ability has to be demonstrated by sustained national or international acclaim, and we'll talk more about what it means exactly. And the person's achievements have to have been recognized in this field of endeavor. And the petition is typically filed with a lot of supporting materials, extensive documentation. The applicant must also intend to continue their work in their respective field, which is important when sometimes people change their field in the years that it takes to for the priority date to become current. So they cannot do that with that, and that's important to keep in mind. And they also need to say that the applicant's entry into the U.S., and that could be a physical entry or getting a green card, both. It should substantially benefit prospectively the United States as a whole. What is also interesting, people sometimes say, well, I have a PhD. Do I qualify for EB1A? Well, not necessarily. It's helpful, but in fact, no academic degree is actually required. You may not have any degree whatsoever and still demonstrate extraordinary ability and your eligibility for this category. It's also a kind of not specifically unique to EB1A, but it's something that defines, you know, the legal framework as consisting of two stages in the legal analysis. First one is based on the list of 10 criteria, where the person has to be able to claim at least three of them, but that's not the end of the end of the analysis, because in the second stage in the analysis, USCIS is going to perform what they call the final merit determination, which we are going to talk about a little bit later. But first, we want to mention all of the criteria.
Thank you, Anna. Going into the criteria, of course, as Anna just explained, right, so you have to show sustained national or international acclaim, right? And the first part, like we said, is just going through these criteria. And the law itself says if you have something like a Nobel Prize, like an Oscar, a Booker, one of those major, major international awards, right? The regulations mention the Nobel Prize, then you qualify. But majority of people don't have a Nobel Prize, so what do you look at? You look at 3 out of 10 criteria. And the first one, of course, is if you don't have that, you look for a lesser national or internationally recognized prize or award which recognizes excellence in that particular field of endeavor, right? So as I said, Booker is for writers, the Academy Awards are for actors, The Nobel Prize, of course, is for different fields in the world, etc. Second, documentation that the foreign national is a member in an association, of an association in a field which requires outstanding achievements of its members. So it's not just the regular run-of-the-mill that we talk about, right? Like everyone tells me, oh, I'm a member of, for example, IEEE. I'm a member of a particular science. That's not what we're looking at, because the membership should be where you are recognized as being a national or international expert in that particular field. Third criteria is published material. So if there are articles written about you in major trade publications, right? If you're going through the process or other major news media, in the articles in the New York Times, in major publications, in you have TV interviews which talk about the kind of work that you've done, which we usually, when we submit it at the Murthy Law Firm, and the regulations suggest, you should include the title, the date, the author of the material, you know, if it is in a foreign language, obviously for a translation. Fourth criteria, that the foreign national, either individually or on a panel, is a judge. So if you've been invited to judge the work of other very top-notch people in the field or in an allied or related field, then it's a very big plus point, because you can't just be invited to judge the work of others unless you're, again, at the very, very top of your field of endeavor. That's the analysis and understanding. And fifth, evidence that the foreign national's original, so they give a lot of weight to original, scientific, scholarly, artistic, athletic, or business-related contributions are of major significance to the field, right? So those are the first five. I'm going to invite Aaron maybe to jump in and go through the next five criteria. Aaron?
So I'm happy to do that too. I have one quick question though. Do you have to meet all 10 of the, you said five, and I'm going to say five in a moment, but do you need to meet all 10 of these criteria? Because as you're listening,
just three as you said at the very beginning. Right, as I said at the beginning,
you only have
to pick three out of 10, but that's the minimal qualification. And then to the point that Anna made, they will then look at it in the final sort of analysis to see if, you know what, there are many times they have said you actually meet three, four, even five, even six out of the criteria, and still denied the EB1A case for people because they said, in the ultimate analysis, in the final merits, we are not convinced that you are truly in that category. So it is a very high classification or category.
Okay, very good. I missed the three, so thank you very much for the clarity. You know, it's funny because the first five sound quite a bit. The next five are also quite interesting as well. Evidence of the foreign national's authorship of scholarly articles that are done in primarily peer-reviewed journals or that are published in major media. Or evidence of display of the alien's work in the field or artistic exhibits or showcases if we're dealing with artists, for example. Also, if you have evidence that the person has performed in a leading or critical role for an organization or establishment that has a distinguished type of reputation. And a lot of times when it comes to playing a significant or critical role, I'll ask the individual, how long did it take for the organization to find you? How long does it take for the organization to replace you if you were to leave? Because sometimes people don't understand whether they play a critical role or not. But if you ask them that question and they say, well, it took them 2 years or 3 years, I don't know how long it would take to find them if I were to leave. These things can help to distinguish that type of position. Evidence that the individual commands a high salary or has a significantly high remuneration for their services. So this is in relation to other people in the field. So if, for example, if you say, I make $200,000 or I make $300,000, which is absolutely a high salary, but if you say, what do other people in your same field make? And that turns out that they're making $500,000, $600,000, or $700,000. So it has to be compared to the people that are in your same field in the same industry. Evidence of commercial success in the performing of arts, as shown either by box office receipts or records or the amount of CDs or or a song sold, et cetera, et cetera. I don't want to date myself and start talking about, the old style, how many records did you sell, so to speak, but certainly how many, how popular your art is and how popular it is that it went around. And also so those are the additional five criteria. And what I would say is that sometimes people are not in fully traditional type of jobs where these 10 criteria is like a direct hit. And sometimes you have to look and say, we don't meet some of these criteria, but there are some comparable types of evidence that are similar to this type of criteria that would establish the beneficiary's eligibility. So to keep that in mind, that these are not an end all and say all, but that but the list from the regulations does give a very good indicator.
Thank you, Aaron. And so we're going to come back to you, Anna, to talk about the second part of the analysis. What have I ever qualified? I think, ooh, yoo-hoo, I need 3 out of 10. Am I going to get the approval now?
Not yet, Sheila. And that's exactly what we've all been alluding to, the second part of the analysis. Very important. Based on a Ninth Circuit decision, matter of Kazarian, that people may see in their Google searches when they do their own research. So this decision established a two-part analysis, and the second one, as we've all mentioned already, is called the final merit determination. What exactly happens during this stage? So USCIS takes a step back, and they look at all of the evidence that the person, the applicant, has presented during the first a stage in their a presentation of their petition. And they look at it, and they look at specifically at the cumulative value of all of the accomplishments, all of the achievements as a whole, and see if it's enough to place that applicant at the top of their field. Now, how can they possibly determine if it's enough, not enough? So there is no specific formula. It's a highly discretionary type of decision-making. Presentation is extremely important, but at the end of the day, they look at the impact that the person's background, their entire history of accomplishments and achievements make on the field as a whole. If it's clear that the accomplishments are moving the field onto the next level with the impact and the dissemination of the work that that person has already completed in the field, that is what you need to show. That's how the second stage in the analysis is done, and that's the goal behind every petition that we file here at the Mercy Law Firm.
Thank you, Anna. And the next question, which is sort of almost very, very closely connected with what Anna just explained, what are some of the major issues that one can find or one sees in final merit determinations? Because that's the crux of the issue when people say, but I don't understand why I didn't get an approval. The government has agreed. The USCIS says you met 3 or 4 or 5 out of the criteria. That's just what happened very recently, a few days ago, with one of my consultations. But as we explained, once you move into the final merits determination, showing the major impact is required, but in some cases it may be problematic in nature. For example, if the work is proprietary or it's federal government or a particular government which requires high level of confidentiality, right? A lot of companies want to keep their innovation secret from their competition, so they tend not to allow sometimes publication of articles. They don't want their work to be talked about before it's out in the market because there are all kinds of copyright, trademark, potential, infringements, etc., right? So then what do we do? So obviously having done this, these kinds of cases successfully for several decades with several hundreds and hundreds, if not thousands of EA and NIW approvals over the last 30 plus years, we recommend to look at the criteria which are more in control of the applicant. For example, what we talked about earlier, like the memberships, the publications, the judging, the review of the work of others, experience in that. rather than purely the awards or the coverage in the media, et cetera. Now, obviously, if you have both, it's far more helpful. And sometimes companies will allow after the fact, for example, to talk about it or publish it once it's out there. But while the process is going on, while they're trying to make sure that they keep their secrets within their company, they may be less willing or reluctant to share that information. So another question which we get asked all the time is, gee, how many publications? Can you give me the number? Is there like a cutoff line? Is there a salary cutoff line? You know, is there, what is the magic number that will help me to get this approval? And I think Aaron is going to jump in. He looks like he's ready to jump in and share something with us. Aaron?
No, absolutely. We want to remind our clients that the eligibility is based on highly discretionary, I want to emphasize highly discretionary standards. At the end of the day, USCIS or the officer at USCIS is going to weigh the cumulative value of all the achievements. And what is enough of a specific criteria for one person may not be enough for another. We often kind of counterbalance a relatively small number of publications with a high journal impact factor, or highlight a high number of citations as evidence of a highly impactful body of work that the person produced. However, overall, we want to see at least a dozen articles published in peer-reviewed journals, for example, to be able to claim that the publication criteria. However, if a person has online publications, not in a major media or very few of them, we may use this also as evidence towards showing original contribution. So it may not be for one criteria of publication, but we may be able to use it for another criteria such as original contribution. Overall, the EB1A success depends in a large part on the effective presentation of all the achievements to the USCIS, so it's clear how the applicant's work has moved their field onto the next level, and to be able to show why they should qualify for that extraordinary ability petition.
Great. Thank you, Aaron. Okay, so next we're going to talk a little bit more about the self-sponsored EB2. So till now we were talking about the EB1A, the extraordinary ability, and now we're jumping to the EB2, national interest waiver criteria, right? So again, here, as we said, you could have a U.S. employer who may file the petition for a member of the class of, you know, either in EB2 or EB3, which most of you know, because most of you or your company's individuals, employees have already gotten, most likely, or in the process of getting an EB1. EB2 or EB3 filing, less likely an EB1. But the national interest waiver, similar to the other case we talked about in the extraordinary ability, the matter of Kazarian, here you have something called the matter of Dhanasar, which is a 2016 case by the Administrative Appeals Office. And in this particular case, the matter of Dhanasar, the USCIS is required to evaluate the following factors when determining whether to approve the EB2 NIW petition. So here, as I said, we can have the employer, you can do it self-petition. Most people do self-petition because they don't have an employer, they've been laid off or what have you, but you still can show I'm both exceptional ability and my work is benefiting the U.S. and the national interest. So that, those are the three prongs, right? What are the three prongs? The first prong is that the foreign national's proposed work or endeavor has both substantial merit and of national importance. Second prong, that the foreign national is well positioned to advance the proposed endeavor. And finally, third, that on the balance, it would benefit the United States or be beneficial to the U.S. to waive the requirement. That's why it's called a national interest waiver. It's a waiver of the requirement of a job offer and thus of the labor certification itself. So a lot of people are like, yoo-hoo, what does national exceptional ability mean? How do I know I even qualify? And I'm going to invite Anna to talk a little bit about exceptional ability.
All right. I want to jump back a little bit so that it's clear to everybody. It's a little bit difficult to understand the terminology that's involved in this particular category. So to qualify for national interest waiver, the person must have either an advanced degree or an exceptional ability. And once they establish either one of the two, then they go into the three prongs that Sheila, you just mentioned. So it's either advanced degree or exceptional ability. Unlike EB1A that doesn't require any degree whatsoever, if somebody doesn't have an advanced degree, not, you know, a bachelor's degree is not enough, but if they don't have an advanced degree or an equivalent, I should mention, an equivalent will also do, they may still qualify based on exceptional ability before they actually go into the three-prong analysis under the matter of Dhanasar, which is a completely different legal framework from EB1 that we just talked about. So it's not to be confused with that. So now, if somebody doesn't have an advanced degree and they are looking to qualify based on exceptional ability, they have to now show that they have a list of six criteria, and they have to show that they meet, you know, at least three criteria out of those, and only after that they can go into the three-prong analysis. So to complicate matters even more, the USCIS applies the same Kazarian type of analysis to the test of exceptional ability. So it's sometimes, you know, if the person doesn't have the advanced degree, then the exceptional ability presents a little more steps in the process, but it's still something that the person may demonstrate even without the degree. So that's a bit complicated, but call us. We'll explain it to you based on your individual circumstances for sure.
Thank you, Anna. And yeah, so similar to what we just said, right? So there you have 10 in the extraordinary ability here. You have six pieces of evidence you try to go through. And it's very different from the other one, but it's somewhat similar in the sense you have to show, you know, that you're exceptional, and exceptional isn't extraordinary. A lot of people think, well, we use those terms in the English language, outstanding, extraordinary. Extraordinary is truly, right, the top. Outstanding is fantastic. Below that, you have exceptional, right? And so here you talk about having a degree, a diploma. If you don't have that, as Anna just said, equivalent. Then you have letters from former current employers. So again, the reference letters are very, very important. The high salary we talked about that applies in the EA category, extraordinary ability. A license. A lot of people have licenses to practice, so the license is helpful. You have membership in professional associations. Again, this is not that very, very super duper high one like the other one that we talked about, but this is just a membership in a professional association, right? That might satisfy the requirements. And so and of course recognition by peers, right? So we're talking about all of those factors or criteria. So that connects, Anna, to what evidence should the applicant provide in support of the NIW petition?
Yes. So what evidence? As you just said, Sheila, all of those things, accomplishments, achievements that we discussed with regard to EB1A would also be helpful here. This threshold is not as high, and the legal framework is completely different, but same letters from other experts would also be helpful. And with regard to the first prong, which is substantial merit and national importance, they kind of combine two, which are very closely related. And the focus here should be on the field of the applicant being, you know, both having substantial merit and also being vital to the U.S. national interest. Same type of evidence to support both arguments, but they are presented separately. So you kind of, as I said, the line is very subtle between the two, but there is a line. and thinking of fields like classroom teaching, for example, or practicing medicine, something that is local to where the person is working, then that would show substantial merit, but not national importance. So this is where the distinction lies. And as I said, as far as the documents, expert letters would be helpful. Information on the background of the field. You can include statistics, definitions, articles. And in our days, you know, the memoranda from the White House on the importance of STEM fields, if that's where you work, that would be very helpful as well.
Thank you, Anna. And so jumping to the second, and so, you know, it's really important, like we said, how the whole thing works hand in glove to be able to meet this threshold requirement. And so in the second prong, you want to show that you're well positioned to advance the proposed endeavor, right? So remember the old case, for those who've been doing it a long time ago, there was called NYSDOT, or New York State Department of Transportation case. That had a slightly different standard that they looked at, and we used to do a lot of petitions back maybe 15, 20, 25 years ago on the NYSDOT standard when that case was brand new case. Now, of course, you have Matter of Dinosaur that has since then sort of taken over and tweaked some of those requirements. So the AEA now provides very helpful suggestions on how to meet this prong. Like, for example, like we talked about, the education, the skills, the knowledge, any record of success in relation to or similar efforts that are being done, or a model or plan for future activities, progress towards achieving that goal or that proposed endeavor, the interest of potential customers, of users, of investors, any other relevant individuals or entities, right? And what are the kinds of evidence? So as we said, you know, you submit your transcripts, publications, citations, views and downloads, professional memberships, review of the work of peers, presentations, etc., right? And you can also provide a full description of the contributions to show progress that demonstrates that you're well positioned to advance the proposed endeavor. And of course, we also, if whenever applicable, provide licenses or contracts, letters of communication from people who are using the work or planning or intending to use the work, statement of future plans to show how this particular field, you know, this particular work will continue to be helpful and really advance the field. And then I'm going to have maybe Anna jump in and talk a little bit about the third prong.
Yes, absolutely, Sheila. I just want to mention before I talk specifically about the third prong that NIW, unlike AB1A again, offers a very flexible standard. So unlike the list of 10 that we discussed, where the evidence has to match specific parameters such as membership or judging experience, with the exception of probably just the regional contributions into the field, when we talk about evidence and the way that we present the case to USCIS in the NIW EB2 category, we are very flexible with, you know, we can present any accomplishments, any achievements, as long as we can tie it to the Matter of Dinosaur standard, we can, you know, very freely use any evidence that's available to us. And that is specifically true with regard to the third prong, which reads as follows. On balance, it would be beneficial to the United States to waive labor certification. So what does it mean exactly? We argue that this prong is established by compelling evidence that we already presented in support of the first two prongs in the analysis. So everything that we've provided so far, it shows that it would be beneficial to waive the labor certification because the offer of employment is waived. So it's in the national interest and it meets all of the other criteria. And then we kind of pose the question, if the other two prongs are have been satisfied already, is USCIS really denying on the third prong? That's not possible. And again, it's a matter of presenting the case in a very kind of skillful way to use all of the evidence that we already have in support of this third and final prong to make, you know, a case and make a lasting impression, hopefully, in the USCIS office's mind. And we also provide a specific explanation for why the petitioner isn't pursuing labor certification. So in a way, national interest waiver, I think about it usually as somebody offering a job offer to themselves. What are they going to do? Why USCIS, why the United States as a whole would want to waive the labor certification requirement? And, you know, sometimes the argument here is a kitchen sink of all of the accomplishments and everything else that we, you know, we've already provided in the in support of the first two prongs. We use articles on impact of immigrants on the U.S. and importance, again, of the STEM field to the U.S., especially nowadays. We also use letters from experts that describe how the petitioner's unique abilities and a record of contributions today has already benefited the United States and how it outweighs the inherent benefit of labor certification. So here, you want to be very creative, because that's what actually probably makes the kind of the final and very compelling point and result can potentially result in an approval.
Thank you very much, Anna, for that very detailed and comprehensive explanation. I'm going to jump to a topic. And by the way, we'll sort of try to round it off. I know we're close to 38 minutes. We always try to wrap it up between 30 and 45 minutes. So hopefully we'll try to wrap up in the next 5 minutes or so. But we can't possibly go to wrap it up unless we have Aaron talking a little bit and discussing the Biden-Harris administration's actions to attract STEM talent, which is referred to as to strengthen our economy and our competitiveness, and how the NIW could be a very powerful tool for people in this regard. Aaron?
Great. Well, thank you, Sheila. You know, up until this point, we've been talking about rules, we've been talking about regulations, we've been talking about 30 years of experience filing these types of cases, both extraordinary ability and national interest waiver. We've also been talking about the matter of Kazarian impact factor. We've been talking about the change from NYSDOT to the new case. All these things that we've been discussing is the way the law has marched its way forward over the last 30 years. What's interesting with the Biden-Harris administration is they focused very heavily on STEM talent, and they focused at STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math. That's going to strengthen our economy, and that's going to strengthen our competitiveness, full stop. So what the Biden-Harris administration did on in January of 2020 is they made an announcement that they said, we acknowledge that somebody who's working in cutting-edge technology in STEM, that this is going to make a difference, and that everything that we do when we're filing for a national interest waiver, we should look out through the prism of this is something that's helping, that's going to help to strengthen our economy and our competitiveness. Anna, you going to say something?
You wanted to say 2022, right? Not
what
2020.
Did I say?
Just wanted to make sure.
2022. If that's what came out, apologies. 2022. Thank you very much. To this end, they made an announcement. As a matter of fact, they didn't just make an announcement. They put it in the USCIS policy manual, also telling adjudicators that when they're looking at national interest waivers, they should look at STEM occupations and look through those colored glasses of recognizing that STEM talent strengthens our economy and our competitiveness, and that each of the prongs should be presented with a focus, in fact, that the individuals in a STEM field. So this is what I refer to as the Biden bump or the Biden-Harrison bump, because it's something that gives people in the STEM fields a little bit of a added advantage when you present the case. The reason why I think this is important is because this year is an election year. And while we're not going to talk politics, because that's not something we ever do, but it's very clear that administrations matter. And the two different major party candidates, they have completely different opinions on how to approach immigration. And so this additional opportunity to be able to file a case if you qualify or if you close to qualify and you have a STEM degree, this is something that we know will be around for a while, but we don't know what's going to happen to it, say, after November or after January of 2025. So it's something to keep in mind that if you have employees, if you have people who could potentially qualify for it, it might be this is the moment to do it, or it just simply might not be able to be as advantageous to file later on. And I want to point out one more point before I let go. If you look back to the time of the Dreamers, where we had the Dreamers and, you know, President Obama said, you know, I'm going to allow the Dreamers to file their cases, and all of them filed the cases. And then there was a change of administration. It was very clear that even though the other administration tried to put a stop to a lot of things, there was a case that came out that said very clearly, if a case is in the pipeline, if a case is in process, that case has to be honored by the old rules, and you have to allow those cases to process. And while that's not a guarantee, I am watching us get closer to November, and I am aware that administrations and policies matter. And this special rule that STEM talent is going to strengthen our competitiveness and strengthen our economy, that's coming from the Biden-Harris administration. And we should just keep in mind that that's something we might want to take advantage of as we can as soon as possible. Sheila, thank you.
Thank you, Aaron. Yeah, no, I think everything makes perfect sense. You want to be proactive. You want to take care of yourself. If you've been laid off, you've terminated, you're afraid of being laid off. Many people just do this as sort of backup insurance. It's like an insurance policy. You just like it. But remember, these are extremely time-intensive applications. It's a teamwork and partnership between Murthy Law Firm, for example, if you hire our team and yourself, because it's a very we need to collect reference letters, collect the documents, put everything together, and create this incredible package to show how either you're a person of extraordinary ability, again, you still have to show prospective national benefit, or you're a person who is of either advanced degree, exceptional ability, and how your work benefits the United States and the national interest, right? And we talked about the different cases. Clearly, at Murthy Law Firm, we have tons and tons of years of experience. In fact, at one point, I remember maybe about 25 or 30 years ago, we used to run a full section in the ALR publication called National Interest Corner, and Murthy Law Firm was basically in charge of providing articles and summaries of our cases 25, 30 years ago of all the approvals we had obtained in that specific category in extraordinary ability and national interest favor cases. Not many, many law firms and lawyers don't do this because it is so time intensive, but our goal always is to take care of our clients, individuals, and their families, employers, and their businesses to ensure that you have all of the options in order to help you and your family stay here, follow the rules, and continue to be successful in the United States of America, a nation of immigrants, and the land of opportunity, as long as we continue to make those opportunities available for immigrants and everybody and every generation coming to this country. So with those wise words, on behalf of Aaron Finkelstein, Anna Stepanova, myself, Sheila Murthy, and the entire Murthy Law Firm team, we want to thank you for joining us today. We certainly hope we will have the privilege and honor of helping you, whether you choose to file an extraordinary ability case, a national interest waiver case, a labor certification, an H-1B, an L-1, whatever, or green card, whatever you decide to pursue, and want to wish you and your family a wonderful summer ahead, and looking forward to continuing to guide you and help you through the various options besides these teleconferences, our articles, our multi-bulletin, our multi-forum, and all of the latest updates that we want to share with you. Take care. Have a wonderful afternoon. Talk to you soon. Thank you. Bye-bye.
This is a free service. The content is the protected, copyrighted property of the Murthy Law Firm. Unauthorized recording or dissemination of these materials without prior permission is prohibited by law. Learn about our firm, how to engage our services, and more at www.murthy.com.